Conscious Business, evolving the world of enterprise.
Episode 22, Spiral Dynamics, a theory about making theories. Don Beck joins us to discuss a revolutionary model of human and cultural development called Spiral Dynamics. Find out more about the model that helped bring an end to apartheid in South Africa and learn about its application in the realm of conscious business. This is part one of a two-part series.
Join the dialogue on ReframeAmerica.com. And now prepare to be transformed. We can think of conscious business as a many-eyed monster that grows with each worker evaluation, productivity study, and visioning workshop. A business become conscious is a life of its own, aware of itself and those within it, aware of the world around it and the impact it makes. Conscious businesses take this growth, this evolution, and integrated complexity seriously, because they know it is what sustains them. But as in all things, there is a balance and there is an appropriate fit.
There is. And today we have an amazing speaker, an amazing author, Don Beck, author of Spiral Dynamics, who has a very rich resume, having worked to end apartheid in South Africa, recently has been working on the resolution of conflict between Israel and Palestine, and has worked with a vast number of companies and cultures all over the world. Welcome, Don.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to spend some time with you.
We're glad to have you. So let's kick it off by just asking, what is Spiral Dynamics?
This particular conceptual model is based on the similar work of late Professor Claire W. Graves from Union College in New York. Mm-hmm. Graves was teaching psychology, graduate psychology courses, frustrated because, as he would explain, each psychological theory, from Freudianism to behaviorism to humanism and so forth, after each of the units, he'd have to say, "Now, students, you must forget that one, because now here's the next one."
Yep.
And at the end of the course, you know, the student will say, "Fine, Professor Graves, which theory is right?" For which he had no answer. Mm. And that sort of spawned him to create a research effort to see if he couldn't track down what it was that was creating different theories, as opposed to simply announce what is next in the sequence of theories. And same thing is true in political science and economic thinking and religious affairs, all these things. Simply reflect different world views, or Weltanschauungen, if you speak German. So that's why he began a lifelong effort of using a research method to identify how and why people seem to embrace different theoretical models, and how and why they change, if they do, and from what to what. And so back in the pre-computer days, with lots of note cards, he assembled thousands of pieces of information about it, and tried to rationalize in the Maslow pyramid of self-actualization, mm-hmm. but found ways of thinking beyond self-actualization. So he and Maslow had a friendly academic debate going on whether or not there are levels yet to develop in humans. Mm. And, so, of course, Graves' theory is, yeah, there are plenty of them.
So he was trying to put together all these different pieces, all these different worldviews that the psychologists were coming up with, that didn't seem to fit, and people weren't really trying to fit together, it sounds like.
Yeah, now this was back in the 1960s. So, you know, it was before most of us were even beginning to raise that question. The man was way ahead of his time in terms of grappling with some very serious problems. And that resulted in what he ultimately produced was, and here's the official title, the Emergent Cyclical Double Helix Model of Biopsychosocial Systems Development. That's why we call it Spiral Dynamics. Vision one for that term, Game Brown. That is a mouthful and obviously a mindful.
Might also have something to do with why his book is so hard to find now.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, he was fun to be with. I mean, he was very creative and very pontifical. You know, he spoke with great authority, scared many of the students to death every time he'd speak. But he was quite serious-minded in terms of really drawn into this research. His dad was a veterinarian, and so he had a lot of exposure to horse brains and horse patterns. And back in the early 1970s, he was National Institute of Mental Health in Washington, claiming that we would discover that these value systems have a neurological, biological, chemical basis to them. Of course, you didn't say back in those days too close to eugenics and Nazi and racism and all those things.
Yeah. So what are some of the main levels of worldviews in spiral dynamics?
Well, now remember, this is an adaptive intelligence. It's not a predetermined Calvinistic script. So the systems he identified are those that were awakened in life conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the first would be a survivalistic system designed for clans and bands and living on the tundra, certainly on the ice floe and the bush and so forth, where it was simply not much different from large animals. We're trying to survive in a very dangerous environment. And over time during the Ice Age, new mind forms emerged because of population mixing, and thus the emerging of the second level, the tribal animistic, which emerged in response once again to changing life conditions,
mm-hmm.
followed in turn by the heroic, egocentric, empire, feudal age, sky gods-driven worldview that once again arose out of the safety and security that the tribal systems were able to produce, thus freeing up the energy of individuals to be renegades and heretics and rebels and break free from the control of the elders and the ancestors. And certainly out of that warlord-driven, gang-characterized worldview emerged a sense of duty, honor, country,
mm-hmm.
that something to contain the more individualistic expressions of self, of raw self, like in Afghanistan, meant that something new had to emerge if the human species was going to survive any longer. And so from that warlord, egocentric life conditions emerged the first living world religions, where they became organized with a ability to think about the future and to think abstractly.
Mm.
From this, during the Enlightenment, the autonomous self longed to be free again from the bumbling monks and monasteries and divine fate control, that there's nothing we can do. It's simply in the hands of the gods. And that frustration led to the development of the autonomous self and the so-called free market system and
mm-hmm.
Freedom of the individual to interpret the Bible on his or her own as a universal priesthood. And in our lifetime, we have really seen the six-level system grow out of modern entity, out of materialism, into, once again, the search for meaning of self. This time, not by an ideology with rules and conformity and punishment, but more driven by a spiritual sense of longing for something that really expresses our humanity at levels in the past that we simply weren't doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously that leads us into the what are called the second-tier systems, which is the next set of value systems that are today beginning to show themselves.
Each of these worldviews, each of these developmental stages is in the world today, how our world is infused with them in many ways. And it seems like the obvious question that arises is, how can we engage with these completely different systems, these different worldviews, from our own point of view?
Well, let me add an additional component here. We have three basic factors. We have life conditions, which are defining elements. Then we have the awakened code, the value system, to deal with those life conditions.
Hmm.
But third, we have the content that particular code has embraced. So one of the opportunities for change is to not bother with the particular value system, and I talked about six of them so far, but also to focus on how those systems express themselves. So a change strategy is often not particularly trying to alter the worldview, but rather trying to provide different ways for that to be expressed.
Right.
Which are healthy, translated, they're in service of the entire spiral. So what we found over time, instead of expecting people to move up the spiral in order to respond to challenges today, the possibility of horizontal shifts into new expressions of the spiral provides a tremendous opportunity. Let me give a quick example. I was in Bethlehem doing a presentation for Hamas, and some of the men took me aside and said, "Dr. Beck, we have a male code of honor that says unless we get our grandfather's house back, and I have a key to it, that I'm not a real man." And I said, "Well, what if I could show you a better way to be a real man, like design an education system for your grandchildren?" They'll say, "Well, that would be better, because probably that house is gone anyway, and I wouldn't want to live in Jewish territory anyway." So rather than try to change that concept of being a real man, the key is to show alternative ways to express it.
That's great.
And that's why when you're working with the spiral, then you work up spiral, down spiral at the same time. You work in all the different layers and levels.
Mm. Yeah,
if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, that does make sense. Like Al Gore in his movie, The Inconvenient Truth, reframed environmental issues as a moral issue, which is at more of that blue level of development that the mythic...
Conventional.
Yeah, conventional, yeah.
And believe it or not, there are evangelical groups that are espousing.
Yeah.
So rather than dismiss, you know, that group as being just not with us, one can show how to bring it along with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we look at how this plays out in the world of business, what kinds of issues do you tend to see arising?
Well, since I work all over the world, I encounter a host of different perceptions on the nature of business.
Mm-hmm.
Only in some of the postmodern societies do you see a focus on consciousness in business. None in Serbia, by the way, when I was there. I mean, it just wasn't there. And the parts of New Orleans where you find the same problem. It's how we define that consciousness. And I think too often it's meditation or it's the spiritual practices. And I'd caution against limiting it, because I think elegant design of the workplace where people have been carefully selected and so they work who they are in terms of the value systems, that in itself to me is a conscious choice.
Yeah.
So working is a joy. It's a thrill. It's a life fulfillment. And that can come from any of the value system codes. So a proper alignment that enriches the lives of people based on wherever they happen to be on the spiral, I think is an element of consciousness, which is extremely important. And because I worked at Southwest Airlines for years, then I actually saw that principle in operation.
Mm. That's great. Yeah, there seems to be something about an appropriate fit that you're really stressing here.
Yes, that's true, but not to lock people in, because life will change. As people solve problems, they'll create new ones. What we did last year to be successful, if continued, might cause us to fail, because there's a constant emergence.
Mm.
So, you know, we insist the importance of sustainability and resilience and emergence and give equal weight to all three of those.
Yeah. It seems really easy to think of, for me at least, to think of any kind of business as a conscious entity. There's an infrastructure that people are bound to. There's awareness of that infrastructure on some level. There's leadership going on. Each individual has their own disciplines that they abide by and their own ways of expanding their consciousness within that. Sometimes it's in minute degrees, and sometimes it's abiding by a very basic morality of simple honesty and decency in the dealings. But sometimes that consciousness is expanded to a depth understanding of team relationships and sophisticated models of how the business works, and also a more sophisticated, wider, more expansive morality as well.
Mm.
Well, that's very well stated. We talk about five bottom lines beyond the typical three.
Nice.
And the first one that we add is a purpose. It's a purpose-driven system beyond self, a cause celeb of some kind. So I just recently challenged Eli Lilly to take responsibility for the immune system of the species Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're just a little pill company. They say, no, not really. when you think about it, if you marked off that field yourself, the other pharmaceuticals would have to join with you. And what if your energy and research were to strengthen the immune system rather than selling us pills after we're sick?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you get great joy and satisfaction from that, because we're talking also about your grandchildren? So that's why we add purpose, you know, to the usual stack of bottom line priorities.
Excellent. And there's another fifth bottom line?
Oh, yeah. Purpose beyond self, certainly. The elegance in the flow of work itself, whether it's just-in-time inventory, lean manufacturing, sometimes it's called, and you see it in Dell computers, sometimes in Walmart, where things are done in elegant simplicity, not wasting resources with ornateness in executive dining rooms. Most certainly social responsibility in terms of meeting the needs of customers, because you're customer-driven, as well as your own employees. Most certainly responsible profit, not in the WorldCom, Enron tradition of huge bonuses for executives. That's why you just really got to love John Mackey at Whole Foods Market.
Yeah.
With the way, you know, he's keeping that from happening, even to the point he now turns back in his salary himself as a model.
Wow.
And then certainly a respect for the ecology of the planet and the profession, like of accounting, in order to maintain integrity in the system. So we speak of five bottom lines, and we have ways to measure them in a company.
So John Mackey at Whole Foods uses your system, or I guess Spiral Dynamics generally, within his organization, and we generally consider, or at least I generally consider, Whole Foods as a prime example of a conscious business. And that they're doing way more than just seeking after profit. At least they have the triple bottom line, if not the quintuple bottom line. Could you speak?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Could you speak?
Well, you know, he studied philosophy at UT Austin. He hasn't had a single course in business, which tells us, I guess, about our business. And the way he started the organization and built it over time has those unique characteristics in it. Well, the fact that he would support people like us working in Israel-Palestine.
Yeah.
You know, because that doesn't connect to his typical bottom line of profit. Yet, you know, he has to be profitable, and so he's made lots of money for lots of people. I was just in his store in London, and it is elegant, and people just flocking to it. And I think that he will probably expand elsewhere too, but when you look at his total way to manage people and to be respectful of the food products, and has his own fisheries, and there's an event, I think, in Stamford, Connecticut, or somewhere back east, where the computers went down, so people were lined up with their, you know, sack of groceries to check out, which they couldn't do, so the manager on site, the team leader on site, made the decision to give them free food.
Nice.
And so they walk through the till and only ask whether you want plastic or paper sacks. And the other thing, that they didn't tell the press. They didn't tell the media.
Wow.
Which I thought was class.
Yeah.
Only when one of the customers told a friend who told the media did the world find out.
Wow.
But that supervisor didn't have to call headquarters and ask permission, because Whole Foods is a distributed intelligence.
That's great.
That is meshed throughout the entire work unit.
You know, one of the things that's so great about Whole Foods to me is, at least in Boulder, the incredible fit that they managed to achieve amongst the people shopping in their stores, their employees, the community itself, and where they're pushing that community. I've experienced founding a cooperative health food store that often acted in competition with Whole Foods, where we pushed the standards as much as we possibly could, and there was incredible friction around that, and it's real different than the experience at Whole Foods, which seems to be really smooth, pushes people a little bit further in their ethical choices, pushes them a little bit further in their health choices, but in a way that people usually feel really good about it. And that seems to capture a lot of the emphasis of your model as well.
Yes, that's your very sensitive to these matters. I was in the Boulder store the other day and found a peanut butter sandwich for whole kids. So I bought a couple to take to the hotel with me. But, you know, whole kids peanut butter sandwich were just, you know, which means somebody on the spot did that. I was in a store in Austin when I went to see John one time, and someone there had come up with these iPods where if you have a dietary problem, maybe diabetics or some other, you know, food concern, they'll let you take that iPod and it will guide you through the store to give you advice as to what you ought to buy, updated each day.
Wow.
Wow.
In fact, I asked John about it when I saw him, and he was not aware of it.
Wow.
Well, now, to me, that's class, you see.
Yeah.
I mean, people at the front end are being innovative in behalf of people like me. So that's a tradition in the store. I mean, it's certainly not perfect, and some people perhaps shop elsewhere, and that's fine. But anytime I'm close to a Whole Foods market, I'm there.
So, Don, you know, it's very interesting that Whole Foods evolved in this way and was able to do this sort of thing. How can other businesses take these principles of spiral dynamics and create organizations that thrive in this way, that have purpose, that have an environmental bottom line and spirituality, and allow for, you know, people at the bottom line, or the bottom, or the customer interface to be creative in that way?
Well, I'm sure there are all kind of ways to do that, and I don't have the last word on it. We talk a lot about natural design, and that of course flows from the most basic decision that people make about the business, about the service, about the industry, about the products, and you literally build your organization around those codes. So when we first started working with Southwest Airlines, the question was, who would be the people who would fly this airline? How would they be different from people who would fly American Airlines? How do you build a company based on these kinds of people with these aspirations and needs and these levels of income? How do you select the kinds of people who can relate to these kinds of people? And then how do you manage them? And what compensation system do you use? So rather than copy any model from anywhere, the idea is to construct one naturally from the situations and the context in which you're operating.
Mm.
And that impacts virtually every area of the company itself. So that basically is how we implement this very complex system. It's not a cookie cutter or a biscuit cutter or a car wash. Rather, it is a process of how should who lead whom to do what with which people living where.
Mm.
So by keeping that design equation in mind, you simply replicate it over and over and over again. And if you've seen the new book on starfish versus spider, with the idea that spider is a metaphor for a centralized bureaucratic command control system where that spider exists at the core of the web. And starfish, if you break off a piece, it will reproduce itself.
Nice.
And so you have to decide what equation of starfish or spider is necessary in different functions in the company.
Mm. So
you won't have a single model imposed everywhere, but you have a single process that's being used.
It's beautiful. So how does this compare with or contrast with the emphasis on building a strong culture that we often hear in more mainstream businesses?
Well, just like a lot of companies in Europe and Australia tried to copy Southwest Airlines,
mm-hmm.
they could copy the business plan, but they didn't know how to copy the culture.
Right.
They didn't know why at certain times of high stress, all of a sudden, ice cream appeared in various work units for people to eat. I mean, they wouldn't understand the commitment to very lucrative profit sharing that today there are multi-millionaires flight attendants in Southwest.
Wow.
Wow.
They wouldn't understand that very unique touch of passengers. Because I don't know if we can reproduce these things. It takes the kind of people with a heart, to be sure, and with a much larger vision about what business they're in and why we're on this planet. And they can see that this is also a way to make money. And so they're not antithetical to each other. And so when all these five bottom lines are stressed and you pay a lot of attention to the selection and placement of people, then all kind of miracles can happen. And there are lots of organizations today in this country and in Europe that are beginning to use this formula. And that's why there's so much interest in so-called spirituality in business.
For commentary and information on my conscious coaching life and leadership services, check out ReframeAmerica.com.